This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Talk of Shame edition. It's Wednesday, September 10th, 2014. Today's show is our annual Morning After, as I said, Talk of Shame edition, live from the Mohonk Mountain House in what town, Julia Turner?
New Paltz, New York, Steve. This is your neck of the woods.
I woke up in New Paltz. Okay, excellent. This has been ritualized as our annual call-in show. To paint the word picture a little bit, all three of us are wearing sunglasses right now, and we each hooked up last night with a floozy from the business side, I think. But the good news is this year, finally, it was a different floozy for each of us. So cheers. Cheers to us. Progress. In all seriousness, how bleary are we? Dana, I'll start with you.
Well, I was just going to say that I'm grateful that for once I don't have to hide my problem on Mohonk weekend. I can just roll in just as blasted as I want.
Excellent. Yeah, it's sort of it's Dana's day is how we privately think of it. But yeah, next year it's an intervention, so get ready. Julia, what about you? How heavy is the head that wears the crown?
You know, I just went to bed at 11 p.m., read a few pages of my book, just turned right in. I'm fresh as a daisy, Steve.
Oh, God.
Fresh as a daisy.
That's what a daisy looks like. Okay, so before we dig in and take calls from our listeners, we have a bunch of business, actually. Julia, do you want to start with that?
Yes. Yeah, we have two exciting live shows to talk about. And the first is our forthcoming live show in Los Angeles on October 8th, featuring, among other folks, the guys from Script Notes, the screenwriting podcast that both Dana and I are fans of. And we have a special guest tout today to get our listeners riled for showing up to this show. Andy Bowers, step before the microphone.
Thank you, Julia. Yes, I just wanted to give a short shout-out to my fellow Angelinos. Even though I'm the executive producer of all these shows that come out of New York and Washington, I actually live in Los Angeles. I was born and raised there. I'm a fourth-generation Southern Californian. And when we were talking about venues for these various shows that are coming up this fall, I said, please come to L.A. L.A. is a very cultured city, despite what you may have heard, and we will have a great turnout for the Culture Fest. Well, okay, and this is just for the Angelinos. Anyone else, you can skip ahead 30 seconds. But Angelinos, there's another show in San Francisco a few days before this one, and it is already sold out. The LA show, it is not sold out yet. Please don't embarrass me. Please make me look good here. Go buy tickets right now at slate.com/LA Culture Fest. Slate.com/LA Culture Fest. It's downtown, October 8th. It's going to be a great show. Do LA proud. Don't let San Francisco show us up. I'll see you there. Thanks.
All right.
A city chastened.
A city chastened indeed. All right. We also have another live show coming up this fall in Boston on October 20th at the Wilbur Theater. I haven't been to the Wilbur Theater since I saw Ani DeFranco there in 1998. So get psyched, everybody. tickets will be available early with a 30% discount to Slate Plus members. They're going to go live on Wednesday of this week. So if you haven't signed up for Plus yet, that's slate.com/culture plus. And then tickets will be available to the general public on Friday. So again, that's Boston at the Wilbur Theater on October 20th. All right, guys, back to our callers.
All right, well, why don't we listen to our first call?
Hi, guys. This is Sarah calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. My question is sort of a parenting-related one, since all of you are parents with kids of different ages, and it's about kind of parenting and personal life balance. My sort of situation is that I'm a relatively new parent with a two-year-old and a second kid imminently on the way. So my sort of desperate plea is for some advice about maintaining sort of not only a relationship with your spouse or significant other, but also sort of a personal inner life while also trying to, you know, be the best parent you can. And it seems like the three of you all have really managed to do that just through your endorsements and what you talk about weekly. So I'm curious as to how you accomplish that. That would be really helpful. Thank you.
First of all, I think we thought we were starting with a softball, but how do you maintain a successful inner life is like kind of a big one to grapple with. But I will say my recommendation for this is have a culture podcast, because then it's your job every week to keep up on some culture, and you have to get a babysitter to go see the movie on Monday night, and sometimes you bring along your husband if you can find that babysitter, and then you get a date, plus you get to watch a movie. Plus you get to keep up on culture. This is not very useful or replicable advice probably to everyone, but it has been very helpful to me. You guys are keeping me sane. This podcast is holding me together.
That is a terrifying thought. I think my answer would be cultivate no inner life before having kids, and then you won't sacrifice one when you do. Also, maybe have your marital relations be somewhat frozen in the middle and tattered around the edges first, and then the transition will be easy.
Just start from a plateau of misery is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you won't notice the shift.
It won't stay level. It'll go down, but it won't go down quite as far. Now, I this is an interesting question, right? Because there's partially a cultural pressure to derive all possible meaning from life from having kids, and to, you know, in as much as it's possible, sacrifice virtually all of your human individuality to their well-being. You know, one thing I would say is that, and maybe this was a completely fatuous self-serving rationalization, but I always thought between the ages of, I'm going to just throw out a number, like let's say 0 and 8 or 12 or whatever it is, you know, you are your child's world, right? I mean, certainly between the ages of 0 months and 40 months, a mother and to a degree a father really literally are a child's entire existential horizon. And then slowly, 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 that becomes less and less the case. And at a certain age, your child becomes capable of putting you in a worldly context because you're no longer the totality of their world. You want to be someone whose life didn't stop entirely for them. So in a weird way, you make this ongoing trade-off that doesn't feel to them to be in their immediate benefit, but is in their long-term benefit, because when they hit adolescence and they're inclined to look at you and call you out as a complete empty fraud, you're less inclined to turn to them and say, "It's because I had fucking kids!"
That was philosophical but not practical.
I actually have some practice. I think everything you just said is profoundly true, and I think especially if the caller, Sarah, has a three-year-old and is about to have another infant, she's going to pretty much have to write off, you know, riffling through large tomes for a little while. But my practical advice would be, and it's not going to be so easy on your body, but at some point when your kids get regular sleeping habits, you either have to wake up early or stay up late,
yeah,
right? I mean, if you really want an inner life and you want that time to, you know, read or watch a movie that only you care about, or, you know, listen to your music without anyone interrupting you, you're going to have to sacrifice sleep. And with the baby the age that hers is, she's going to be sacrificing it anyway, so I can't pile more on top. I think you should guiltlessly soldier on as best you can until they have sleep habits, and then figure out your time and do it. That's my advice.
I also would say, like, leave your kids behind for a weekend. Like, do it on your anniversary or go to a wedding or just, like, it's good to have time being a grown-up with your partner.
But that still is bonding with your partner, which, important as it is, it doesn't provide that thing. You know, I know exactly what she means about the inner life. And I was so used to, I had kids so late, and I was so used to having vast stretches of time to just read and walk and stare contemplatively out of cafe windows. And that stuff is just like long gone.
The thing I miss is the staring at the wall time. I don't have staring at the wall time. Like, I used to have a roommate, and we watched the complete 7 seasons of Buffy all in a row, like one in 1 4-month stretch. And so we would watch an episode or two before bed, and she would be 60-0. Like, we'd turn it off, credits would roll, and she would, like, already have a toothbrush in her mouth and, like, lights out and in bed, you know, 60 seconds later. And I would just kind of sit in the same chair, like, looking at the closed TV and just kind of, like, process my day for 25 minutes before I went and rustled myself into bed. And I'd never do that anymore. I miss that time.
What I love about that a vignette is that it draws this great distinction between the thing that you miss isn't the binge watching of Buffy, though you may miss that too, right? What you really miss is that purely contemplative moment without interruption because the roommate's asleep. So having kids in a way makes that distinction, which can get muddled, right? Which is like really doing something for your inner self and like getting a latte whenever you want and watching, you know, a TV show whenever you want. Like, you suddenly, that's a very enforceable and distinct, you know, division once you have kids, right? Because you can kind of do the Buffy maybe a little bit, but it's something is more challenging about finding that, you know, like one of my favorite things about the Mohonk retreat is that it at the end of it, it gives me that melancholy 9-year-old whose birthday party has ended feeling. Like, you know, something goes a little concave inside of me and I just feel bereft, and I go to the Rosendale Cafe one town over and eat lunch alone. And it's just like there is something about that that's even better than the latte whenever you want it and Buffy.
Yeah. No, it's true. I feel like this is a place here where I should acknowledge, not a critique, I think a commentary on how my podcasting style changed after I returned from maternity leave, that was issued by our fellow podcaster Noreen Malone, was out somewhere and saw my husband and said, I really like Julia's free jazz endorsements that she got back. They're a little bit like weird. And it's like, right, because I don't watch TV shows anymore. I've turned into you guys. I used to be able to sneer at you guys for not keeping up with everything. And now I'm going to endorse this potted plant this week. Anyway, so the free jazz, it's been an in-joke in my house, but now I share it with you and our listeners. The Julia Turner free jazz endorsement is a product of my parenting life, I think.
Okay, can we agree we've done some justice to this question? Should we move on to another one?
Let's move on.
All right, excellent. Let's hear the next call.
Hi, this is James in Seattle, Washington, and I had a question for the call-in question show. Here's a hypothetical situation. You have the chance to become instantly fluent in any language in the world, kind of like Keanu Reeves learns Kung Fu in The Matrix, but with a language. The catch is that you will only be fluent for 7 days. So after 168 hours, you will lose all ability to speak this other language, or you will lose all ability back to whatever, however much you can do right now. So the question is, what language do you choose to learn, and what do you do with your 7 days of fluency? Thanks.
My gosh, this is my dream. I wish this were true. Maybe James is like a genie and we can actually do this.
And yet losing it, it's like so, it's so Flowers for Algernon though, right? Like, you get the superpower and then you have the horrible, you know, experience of losing it. But anyway, I'm curious what, you know, let's start with the polymathic Dana
Stevens. I don't know. It's a crazy question. I wish that the asker were here for further interrogation, because the whole conceptual framework of the question to me changes which language it would be. Hmm. You know, there's some languages that I would love to learn, but I want to know them forever, you know, and I don't want to give up after 7 days. I think because of that framework, I would choose a language that would be very difficult to learn otherwise, and that would let me glimpse a culture that I would never otherwise see. Mm-hmm. If I could go back in time, if we could bundle in some time travel, I would learn like ancient Greek or Proto-Indo-European or something, and just like go like experience the language at its roots. But since we don't have time travel included, I'm going to say Japanese, because that seems very hard to learn. It seems very interesting to tour around Japan, but I think I could live with letting it go after 7 days.
Yeah, I think Proto-European has to go sit over there in the corner with birdsong and the gamelan for a little while. We'll let it know when it can come back.
Should we just add a time travel element to all the questions we get today? Tina's like, well, of course, we have to consider if time travel were included. Is that just like a default, like, level up?
Let's just factor that in, yeah, okay. As a default.
This is a tough question for you to answer, by the way, because it only takes you 14 days to learn a language. Right? Julia, what do you think?
Well, wait. How many languages do you know, Dana?
I don't know that many languages.
But you were like a comparative literature PhD. Like,
I would say that I know Portuguese and French. I can speak them. I've taught them. You know, I have some level of fluency, although I would need to brush them up. Spanish I can understand because of the Portuguese, and that's about it.
Well, I think my choice here, it is a strange construct. I studied Chinese for a year, Mandarin, and it was super interesting. And I live in Chinatown in New York. And I think that it would be great to instantly know Chinese and then do a big tour of China, basically. I mean, I really want to go there. I'm super interested in the culture because of the aforementioned children, like my year abroad in China that I thought I was going to have when I was 19. Doesn't seem like it's on the horizon anytime soon. Mm-hmm. You have another 10 or 15 years. So that's like a place and a culture I'm super interested in. And it was super tantalizing to get the beginnings of that language. Like, it works in such an interesting way. The mechanics of it and the syntax of it and the grammar of it are totally different and interesting from the other Romance languages I've studied. So I guess that's kind of a boring answer. The other one, I guess, would be Hindi. Like,
Yeah, it seems like the 7 days limitation makes you want to go somewhere farther outside of your comfort zone, right?
Okay, well, I'll gainsay that a little bit, and mine would be German. If you've ever read the novel White Noise, which is a brilliant novel by Don DeLillo, there's a hugely funny set piece in it in which this professor. He's a professor of Hitler studies, which he has the virtue also of having invented. And so he's become an eminence in the field without ever learning German, and he's kept it secret from the academic community. And if he's ever exposed, he's in terrible trouble. And there are these hilarious scenes of him trying to learn it, and he's like literally trying to peer down the throat of the person teaching him in order to see where these guttural, mangled sounds come from. And I've had a similar experience trying to learn German. I find it, you know, it would take an amount of work and intelligence that I don't have. But the reason I'd like to know it and the reason why I could accept knowing it only for 7 days is I have a very specific objective in the German language. The first would be to read Nietzsche in the original, right? The most alarming, startling, disruptive thinker who ever lived. He's so Germanic. He's responding so deeply and intimately to a Germanic tradition in philosophy. He's both part of it and exploding it. It would just be amazing to me to have
that
experience.
The 7 day thing makes that too heartbreaking. I thought about languages that I would love to master the literature in, like German, but then I just feel like that Flowers for Algernon moment that the Nietzsche book is slowly becoming more and more incomprehensible. It's too sad.
You'd have the memory of it, I guess. But the second more definite objective would be I'd want to read not only Heidegger, but I'd want to read about the Heidegger controversy, which is once again boiling over, right? There's a big conference at CUNY this week. His Black Notebooks books are about to be published. And there are a lot of people, especially the people who want to indict Heidegger as a Nazi. I mean, he was a Nazi and he deserves to be morally, you know, reprimanded through all of history for it, execrated really through all of history for it. But the question of how much that implicates his philosophy and implicates the adherence of Heideggerians, to me, is an open and interesting one. And I'm just at this total disadvantage to people who can read it in the original. And I would love to take 7 days, read the notebooks, which are as of now untranslated, and all the other arcana that are used to say, look, there's a total connection, you know, both ways between Nazism and Heideggerian philosophy, which may be true. I would want it to not be true, but I'd be willing to accept it, obviously, if it were true and ignore Heidegger for the rest of my life. But I don't know it to be true because there's this barrier between me and it. And once I had that knowledge, even in my Algernon moment, I would at least be able to make an argument, you know.
I'm imagining your clock begins ticking for your 7 days and you just disappear into a room with like 50 giant German tomes.
I also love like winning arguments in some imaginary future in which I say, during the 7 days that I was fluent in
All right.
All right, I think we can go. Yeah. Next one, third call. All right, here we go.
Hey, guys, it's Jordan in Boston. And I'm just wondering, this time of year is the film festival season. We just had Telluride. Toronto's coming up, New York Film Festival in a week or so. And I'm wondering, there are so many different reactions that come out of these festivals, and unfortunately, I think a lot of them are geared toward the Oscars and what film is getting the most buzz. And maybe Dana in particular could comment on this, but how much attention should someone who's a film lover like myself give these sort of festivals? I mean, I'm excited about a lot of these movies that are premiering, but at the same time, I feel like the only reactions I can find most of the time are so-and-so is going to get a Best Actor nomination, and this film is a lock for a Best Picture nomination. And as accurate as those have perhaps turned out to be in the past, it's not something I'm particularly interested in as a film fan. So do you guys take excitement in following these sort of film festivals, or is it something that maybe we should just put off until the film is actually released? Thanks so much.
Yeah, I think I'm probably the same kind of film goer as Jordan. I mean, I would sort of say, based on that question, you can dismiss film festival dispatches if they're not interesting to you. That said, I don't usually go to film festivals because, A, Slate doesn't really cover them for the very reasons that he's mentioning. They often show movies months before they're distributed or before they have distribution. And so it is sort of a connoisseurs and critics affair. And personally, for myself, I don't like to know that much about movies before I see them. I hate festival tweets, which to me always have this sort of, you know, I'm in Venice and you're not kind of tinge to them. That said, I got sent to Sundance this year, not by Slate, but by Sundance, because I was on a jury in January of 2014, and it was a great experience in terms of just getting a sort of a view of what was coming out for the rest of the year. So in terms of sort of like having things in my pocket, you know, I've seen Boyhood 6 months before it comes out, so I can put some thought into it. That was great. But as far as how you transmit that connoisseur's culture to just the culture of film consumers who are waiting for the movies to arrive in theaters, I think it's too early to start caring. It's too awards-focused, and it's just part of that whole gearing up of the industry for its annual rites of self-congratulation, mm-hmm. and it's not the funnest part of film going.
But I have a question, and I've wanted to ask you this for a long time. Is there a festival goggles that are like the rough equivalent of like the beer goggles I was wearing at 3 o'clock in the morning this morning. and do you see the movie in a different way? It's, I mean, would that be in the wild? I guess seeing it in the wild would be just going to a multiplex and paying for it. Like, you know, I often find that there's this huge grade inflation sometimes when people see things at a festival. They're sort of rooting for it.
I think that's true, especially at certain glamorous festivals, like at Cannes or Telluride or something. You know, at places that really do have a sort of I'm here and you're not glamour about them, mm-hmm. there probably is some kind of rosy grade inflation and a little bit of a sense of I have to have an intense experience here because I came all the way to this festival. You know,
yes.
I have to see something brilliant.
And I'm also part of the community. I'm now part of the community that produces movies. I mean, is the critic susceptible to those seductions? Like, do they sometimes sit you at a table with Brad Pitt?
I mean, I'm not enough of a festival goer to respond to that. I really,
yeah.
Sundance was literally my first time at a big industry festival,
yeah.
you know, actually where you actually go to a hotel and go to movies all day. I'll go to the New York Film Festival or something in town. But yeah, it has a kind of exoticism that was an interesting novelty for the first time, but I would say in general that it's a little bit too much interpenetration of industry and PR and criticism to quite know what to do. Also, how could you write valuable film criticism from a festival? I can't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You're spending the whole time logistically planning your day and seeing movies and waiting on lines, and at the very most, you can just, you know, tap out a quick blurb here and there.
But shouldn't film fans be excited about festivals because of the role that they play in discovering movies? I mean, I have, you know, several friends who are young filmmakers and directors whose films have ended up in these festivals, and that's how they've been discovered, and that's how they've gotten distribution. And, like, the festivals, just if you're, like, looking at Lena Dunham's Instagram, seem, you know, swishy and off-putting. But if you're thinking about it from the perspective of how new talent gets discovered, aren't they kind of important?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly important. You know, they're part of the whole machine of the industry, which I don't mean to completely disdain. If it weren't for festivals, you know, distributors wouldn't be able to see interesting small things that they might not know about and be able to distribute, and we wouldn't be able to see them. And so there's important work going on there in terms of, you know, getting movies out to the public. And I'm sure if you're a young filmmaker who's got a film there, it's a whole different feeling than somebody like me who's trying to, you know, create decent prose. Like, you're there having your work recognized, and that has to feel really good.
Yeah, I got to go to a screening a couple of years ago with a friend of mine whose movie was at South by Southwest, and it was just like kind of amazing to be in that theater and watch him watch people watch it for the first time. I think he like left the theater in the middle because he was like too nervous. But, you know, I have no desire ever to go to a film festival like and see multiple movies in a row in one day. That's just like too much for my brain as a movie consumer. But to see it from his perspective was totally thrilling and fun.
I have to say, I totally enjoyed going to Sundance as a jury member, but that's a very, very different experience. I wasn't responsible for writing anything every day, you know, and you're sort of a VIP. Like, you get taken to the screenings and, you know, you're not sort of schlepping by bus from place to place.
You're just there to
exercise your judgment. Yeah, exactly. No, it was, that was like the firmament of festival going. And still, I felt like I enjoyed it, but I don't feel driven to attend every film festival.
You know, it's funny. It's speculated about the wine critic Robert Parker that one of the reasons he so favors Bordeaux, French Bordeaux over Burgundy, and California Cabernets over Pinots from Oregon and California, is because he tastes so many wines that his, beyond a certain point, your palate burns out, and you need a wine to be huge in the sense of like large alcohol and a ton of fruit forward on the palate in order just to experience it. And this, in turn, has shaped the way like people plant vineyards. Like, it seems to me there must be something similar as a film critic, not even at a festival, just what is it like just to see these movies on a professional basis, an ongoing basis, all the time? I mean, at a certain point, do you want to just like palate cleanse and not watch any movies or you know, I don't know, stick your head in the sand and twirl?
That's a whole different question, but yeah, I definitely feel the need to palate cleanse. I regularly feel the need to palate cleanse and just have to try to do it, you know, on the fly.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we bump up to the next call?
All right.
Hi, guys. My name is Sam Fayez, and I'm calling from New York City. I'm obviously a huge fan of the show. Anyways, I was recently reading the top 10 essays written since 1950, which was a topic of one of your past shows. And I got to Susan Sontag's Notes on Camp, in which she sort of outlines the cultural contours of what it means to be campy or camp in a post-war cultural milieu. Anyways, it got me thinking, if you individual cultural gabbers had to write an essay on the most salient cultural sensibility of our day, what would it be and why? Thanks very much, and keep up the great work. Take care.
I think Steve has to answer this one first, because this, Steve, this is the sort of piece you would actually write. This is like, I'm going to take whatever you say now as your first assignment for once you turn in your book.
I think it's the kind of piece that I could convince an editor to assign me. Whether I would write it is always about a 20-80 proposition, but okay, I'll dig right in. So when I was a kid or adolescent, I used to go over to friends' houses, and if the parents had books on their shelves, almost invariably you would find a copy of a book called The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard. And Vance Packard had pretty much all but disappeared from the cultural consciousness by the time I was an adolescent in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s. But this book seemed to be ubiquitous on the shelves of people who were then over the age of 40, so it must have been a huge bestseller. You know, similarly, my children will go to the houses of friends and there will be bookshelves and they'll see The Tipping Point. Now, The Hidden by Malcolm Gladwell. So the Vance Packard book is basically an argument about how sinister marketing is and advertising has become at that point in the 50s or 60s, and basically saying that it appeals to one's semi-conscious mind, it stimulates false desires, and ultimately it undermines our collective capacity to sustain a public sphere governed by reason, right? Well, Malcolm Gladwell is the Vance Packard of his day. If you just simply, they're exact equivalents if you just reverse all polarities, right? In effect, what he is he's the grand wizard marketer of marketing. And he took all of these residual fears that, you know, kind of high modernist American thinkers, intellectuals had about marketing and advertising and corporate, you know, the way corporations stimulate desire and shape public debate, and basically said they're not sinister at all, and made virality itself a kind of virtue, into a kind of inherent virtue that can't really be disciplined by any priestly or extrinsic, you know, standard. And so I'm going to go with Malcolm Gladwell. I think he's kind of the great, you know, neoliberal apologist in a way. And he, for better and for worse, embodies this position that, incorporates into it, this kind of very populist sociology, neuroscience. It's very empirically driven, data driven. It seems purely factual, but in essence is an argument for modes of persuasion that people used to find suspicious, at least.
But Malcolm Gladwell isn't a sensibility.
Oh, he's totally a sensibility. Are you kidding? Absolutely, okay. He's a sensibility, okay. And you see it expressed everywhere. I mean, it's like it seeped into the culture at large via other venues since, but like Freakonomics and, everyone who's kind of name-checking neuroscience and sociology and, this data, supposedly data-driven arguments, all of that derives from the early successes of Malcolm Gladwell. I mean, if The Tipping Point hadn't been a huge bestseller, we wouldn't be seeing all these books in its wake.
Well, it's more that he successfully synthesized all of those currents in thought, right, and kind of brought together marketing and neuroscience and psychology and all of those things in some palatable and easily accessible way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's still not an abstract noun like camp, but I'll allow
it. We live in the Gladwellian era. That's your contention.
It is. But I have a better answer now that I think about it. But anyway, go ahead.
We can go around twice.
Yes, exactly.
Dana, what have you got?
I don't know. See, unlike Steve, this is the kind of question that always sends me scurrying, like the big what do we live in the age of kind of question. I never know how to formulate it. I mean, I think my response would be something that is really obvious, but I think is the most evident change in my way of living over the last 15 years or so, which is just that we live in the age of sort of magpie information consumption, and that the world more than ever has become this, endless huge stream of data that we can all access and repurpose and put together in the way we want, which also has a better and a worse, obviously. Mm-hmm. In other words, rather than perceiving of the world as something that we have to go out to, we perceive it as something that comes to us and that we then pick and choose and consume from.
It's interesting. I have two answers here, and one is very similar to yours, Dana. I think you could do notes on data. I mean, just there is more data, and then there is a cult around data, which is kind of related to your topic too, Steve. But the notion that, even as a magazine editor, like we have more data on what our readers read and what they like and what they respond to and what they spend a long time, reading and what they spend less time reading and what they click on and which headlines work and what size the image should be. I mean, there's so much data. Like, to be a magazine editor on the internet right now as opposed to being a print magazine editor 25 years ago, you threw someone on the cover, you figured out whether people bought it on the newsstand or not. You never knew whether they really loved it for that, the lead feature about X or the, profile in the back about Y, apart from like a few letters that would get snail mailed in. And so the question of how do you incorporate that data into your decision making without becoming a complete data fanatic is totally interesting. And that's the editorial way that it touches on my life, but I feel like that's happening everywhere in the culture, in all kinds of industries, in creative industries, in more typically data driven industries. So there's data. The other one I think you could do is notes on outrage. I feel like we live in a moment of high dudgeon, and the whys and wherefores of that would be interesting to explore.
This is a big question, so I hope people won't mind that I gas on a little bit further. I mean, I think what I would revisiting Gladwell for just one second, what I would say is it went beyond marketing and into the market. I mean, you would say data, and I would agree with you. But I would add to that the overarching conceptual framework for understanding this, otherwise seemingly undifferentiated mass of raw information is the market. Like, the market is the thing that shapes everyone's understanding of common human reality now. And I certainly implied in Malcolm's work is that there are neutral and morally neutral algorithmic processes for creating, unguided processes for creating outcome, success and failure outcomes, which is kind of quasi-Darwinian. And that leads me to another name, which is, I would say, a couple of the other sensibilities that are really defining of our time would be Richard Dawkins, the cult of Dawkins, and the notion of unguided Darwinian processes producing outcomes, including human consciousness and reality. The other one I would say is Warhol. Warhol had really fallen into not disrepute, but he was becoming an irrelevant artist in the 80s, because everyone considered he'd done his best work in the 60s. He cameoed on The Love Boat. He himself in his diaries lamented that his prices were lagging far behind his pop artists' contemporaries, Rauschenberg and Johns, which of course is not nearly the case anymore. And he enjoyed this massive revival right around the neoliberal turn, like in the 80s, and he died, I think, in 87 or 88. In 89, there was a huge retrospective for him, either at MoMA or the Met. I can't remember. It may actually have been the Met. And from that point on, Warhol became not only a dominant, like the most dominant artist of the second half of the 20th century without question. I mean, you know, rivaling what Picasso was to the first half of the 20th century, he became the air that we breathe, right? Like the celebritification, you know, the disappearing hand of the artist. It's, of course, what gives us Koons, but way more than that, it gives us no language by which to say Koons is a fraud, which I think is interesting relative to how people have been forced to respond to the Koons exhibit, more of which later in my endorsement, but anyway.
All right, excellent. Let's hear the next call.
Hi, my name is Brett. I'm calling from New York. I just want to say thank you for doing the bit you did on children's literature. As a father of a small child, I was had been hoping that you would do that. And I sort of even went as far as buying Little Fur Family and singing the song in the prescribed fashion. I was actually wanting to ask you to extend that conversation a little bit about television, as to, in terms of early childhood, as to what you let your children watch, whether you let them watch at all, what you thought was great. Did you have preconceived ideas about, prohibiting television and then, like the rest of us, just giving up because there are too many hours in a day? I'm hoping you'll focus this, as my child is 2.5 years old, on something that I can practically take and show him. So far, I'm at Sesame Street, Elmo level. Went to Bugs Bunny, but felt that that was too old for him. I just want to know what it is that you love, recommend, or don't show at all. Okay, thanks.
Ooh, I'm excited about hearing the answer to this one, because we are in the phase of not letting our kids watch television before we go over that waterfall into letting them watch television, which we have no pretensions that we won't do at some point. But I don't know when to do it or what you're supposed to show them or anything. What did you guys do?
Oh, I'm so lateraling this one to Dana Stevens.
Well, I can respond scientifically in Gladwellian fashion to your query about when you should start. At least according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, your child should be 2 before they have any screen time, because supposedly their brain can't process the images or something, whatever. It sounds a little Waldorf-y to me, and I don't think there's any harm in a younger kid watching. But I think when your kid does start to watch, I would recommend for your boys and for this guy that Miyazaki be their first film.
Whoa.
Would you? Do you hear me
Whoa.
On that?
I'm like not sure. Miyazaki kind of freaks me out.
Well, maybe if you're not a fan yourself and you don't think you're going to love watching it with them, but My Neighbor Totoro is the first film my daughter watched when she was probably 2, 2.5 in there somewhere. And it is still one of her favorite movies and one of our favorite movies. And I feel like to me it is now like a source of infinite richness
and
where I can watch any scene from it.
We should say that that's in Proto-Indo-European, but it is subtitled. I really would go with Tarkovsky as a first director, auteur.
You guys don't understand Miyazaki. This particular Miyazaki, the little kid Miyazaki, of which My Neighbor Totoro is, I think, the pinnacle, is like a gentle little fairy tale. The reason it should be your kid's first movie is that there's nothing freaky about it. It is essentially about living the fantasy of having your own giant, puffy, gray teddy bear that lives in the woods that you can go cuddle with. It's such a wonderful first movie.
There's no haunting, shape-shifting, weird ghoul in the background who like jump up and like give you sparkly candy that evaporates into the night, or like whatever the hell happens in Miyazaki movies.
You're thinking of Spirited Away. I think that all happens in Spirited Away.
Happens
in a kid's brain every day.
I've never loved anything more than your haunting, willowy wood ghoul hand gesture. Julia, that was awesome. That is Slate triple plus right there. Oh my lord. Let me just begin by saying I'm not quite sure what you start them on, but whatever you do, keep them the fuck away from Teletubbies, which is brain crack for little kids. It just seems wrong to expose them to it.
I guess this is the wrong time to say that I still sometimes pop in the old VHS of Teletubbies.
Just for yourself?
I enjoy going to that strange mental zone. I guess I was never a club kid going to raves, but I can live it all through Teletubbies.
Oh my God,
this
Dana,
is your parental culture experience.
It's so much worse than I ever thought.
When everyone else goes to bed, you just like
that's my
get
inner
out
life.
A glow stick on Teletubbies.
Please tell me you spark up some 420 before you do that, Dana.
My neon pacifier on a chain is just waiting for me.
At least be totally fucked up on an illegal drug before you do that.
That's the great thing about Teletubbies. It obviates the need for any substance whatsoever.
That's true. I can't really recall what... Well, in terms of policy, I kind of agree, like, you know, probably not totally poisonous to let them see something before the age of two, but I don't think my
what's
kids
the point?
Really... Yeah, what's the point? And probably better not to, and why not? Then after that, you know, kind of pretty restricted. I would say another big thing is not live feed TV with commercials. I mean, that you know, I hate to be puritanical about it, but
it's so easy to avoid that now. It's like,
exactly.
Why do it?
No, exactly. And right, it hardly needs to be said. But I would say that is a big one. Like, no, the commercials are just awful, and the manipulations of it are awful. As they get older, I have reservations about some of the you know, Disney programming, some of which can be quite good, but. A lot of it, or too much of it, is designed in a very specific way. You have a 15-year-old actress playing a 12-year-old girl appealing to the faux mature sensibilities of the 9-year-old audience, right? And so there's this kind of sassy equals mature in the mind of a 9-year-old girl, especially as they start watching these shows, and you get a set of affectations, and you don't know where they come from, and then you watch 10 minutes of iCarly, which is in some ways a supremely intelligent and funny show, but it does encourage your kid to think that they're grown-up, even though, ironically, there are no grown-ups depicted in the TV series, right? Enough said. But as to what was admirable and likable on television, I'm trying to remember. I mean, my kids watched stuff that I thought was wonderful. I mean, in all seriousness, Miyazaki is great.
I feel like we didn't do that much TV, but what about movies? I mean, you have to have Mary Poppins, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, I would say very early on, my kids responded to the Marx Brothers and Buster Keaton. The stuff like that, it hits them so...
It's true. There's no one alive who doesn't get why Buster Keaton is funny.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, I'm gonna take these suggestions and put them in the vault for the next 6 months. Then I'll crack them out. All right, next question?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Laura in Wisconsin. I'm 27, and all of a sudden, I like the taste of tea, and I'm using eye cream and thinking of starting a garden. So I was wondering what your favorite things about getting old are. Thanks. Bye.
That was beautiful and concise. Dana,
what sells me on that question is the three things that mark this 27-year-old is now getting old. I love it. Tea, eye cream, and starting a garden. Hello, Grandma.
It's a little old. I get it. Starting to use eye cream is like a total rite of passage. I still don't really use eye cream.
Yeah, me either. Why do your eyes need a special cream? I guess just looking at me will tell you the answer.
I feel like crow's feet are the best like aging face thing.
Yeah, they're very French.
Crow's feet are so like elegant and lovely. Gotta have your crow's feet. What are your favorite things about getting old, Steve? You're the oldest.
I know, I am. My favorite things about getting old are, you know, the youngins get up and give me a seat on the subway. No, I mean, I think it's you come into all of the young fogey opinions that you've held your entire life, and you start to increasingly air them with a sense of impunity, though in fact you have none of the impunity that you're assigning to yourself internally. I don't know. I almost want to punt on this one because the sort of serious answer would be, you know, you or let me repeat an anecdote that when I heard it I didn't believe, but now that I am the age I am, I totally believe it. My wife went out to lunch with a mentor of hers, and he told her a story about a lunch that he had just been to the day before with his mother, who, you know, so he was probably in his 60s, and I think she was in her 80s or 90s. You know, she went to the like Cosmopolitan Club for her, you know, annual lunch with old friends or whatever, and they were all sitting around talking about if they could be any age again, what age would it be? And what I like about getting older is how that answer grows along with you, because they all said they wanted to be 60. None of them said they wanted to be 35. And the reason they gave was, you know, wisdom isn't this
faked compensation that you claim for yourself, even though you feel like you've lost all of the good things in life. It actually is this wonderful, it is wonderful to shed some of your dopiness and lostness. And they said 60 was the age where they still fully had their health. They could do all of the things that they physically wanted to do in their lives and had reached a kind of plateau of human wisdom and maturity. And that having those two things together made being, you know, between the ages of 55 and 65 or 55 and 70, the heart of life. That was life. That was when life was the best because you had perspective. You knew who you were. I mean, think about how vulnerable you are to the world when you're younger. You tend to forget that. You allow too many things to shape and reshape your inner life and your sense of yourself that are contingent and worthless. And it's such a horrible answer, but it's true. I just think, you know,
wisdom.
Wisdom. Oh, shoot me now. Glue factory.
I like it. I like that answer.
I find that so surprising and beautiful that they all chose that same zone.
Yeah, it's not a true story.
Dana, what about you?
I don't know. Maybe my answer is changed by Steve's answer. That's so great. I mean, my answer was just going to spark off a much less kind of personal anecdote, which is that I was leafing through a Diane Keaton book in a bookstore. She has a new kind of memoir, you know, like sort of style guide thing out. And much as I love Diane Keaton, she is not a writer in any way. It seemed like a very sort of gushy, slightly name-droppy book. But she had a little tossed-off sentence about getting older that really moved me, and I've thought about it since, that was something like, when I was younger, you know, she was talking about her days as a Broadway actress and sort of trying to make it big and trying out for roles. And it was something along the lines of, I'll paraphrase it badly, but when I was younger, I wanted to be the most beautiful, sparkly thing in the room. I was very concerned that sort of I was the beautiful thing. And now that I'm older, I want to see the beauty outside of me. You know, it's just the idea that, you know, you can stop being the sort of the source, the narcissistic source of admiration, and start to admire the world around you. And that's maybe a little related to what you just described.
That's lovely, yeah.
Yeah. Diane Keaton for the win. My idea is just as familiar, but I don't have a charming anecdote to go with it. I don't think. But I just think the best thing about getting older is you get so much centered in your own skin. Like it's a different way of saying, I think, the same thing you said, Steve, but you just know who you are. You know how you feel about things, and you're not constantly checking that against. I think when you're young, you're still trying to figure out what kind of person you're going to be. And so you have feelings, and then you have a sense of who you want to be, and then you have a sense of who the people around you think you should be. And you're always kind of trying to triangulate between those things and square them up and figure out where to center yourself. And it just feels like as you get older, you're just like, oh, no, I have my views. I have my perspective. I am who I am. That's going to go over great with some people and not with others, and that's fine.
And that improves your relationship so much, too. If you can walk into a room thinking, I know who I am, and now let me find out who these people are, you know, it's completely different than the calculus you make or I made when I was 23, when I walk in and think, in some unconscious jumble, you know, who am I? Who can I impress? Who scares me? You know, all that you see the world more, I think, as an antagonist and less as like a place that you can move freely in, maybe.
It's interesting because that comes back to the Diane Keaton idea, too, of like, are you so confused about yourself when you're younger that you have to be a little bit of a narcissist? Like you have to get caught up in your own brain and your own hangups, and you have a less clear vision of everything around you.
Right. You can't just fast forward to that place. You do have to actually create a self, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's important. Like the definition of narcissism is self-centeredness without a self, right? And people sort of forget the second half of that definition, you know, which is a recipe for disappointment bordering on rage, and to lose that is one of life's great, you know, gifts.
This has gotten kind of philosophical and profound, you guys.
God, shoot us now, all of us. We're like old frickin' horses.
It's now. The lakeside air. We're just in rockers.
Yeah, exactly.
Just thinking about life. I like thinking about life with you guys. All right, last question.
Hi, Culture Gabfest. This is Peter from D.C., and my question is, have you ever considered something for the endorsement segment and then decided to just keep it for yourself? Perhaps in the more intimate setting of the Slate Retreat, you'd be willing to share with us what that something is. Thanks.
I've never told you guys even if I've done that. Have you?
I mean, I guess I feel like I'm probably always doing that on some small level. There are probably little revelations that I have that are somehow too nuanced or personal or sort of hard to describe briefly to make it into endorsements. So, yeah, I think my answer would be yes, and I'm still keeping them to myself.
How about you, Steve?
No, for the purposes of this conversation.
I'll never tell.
All right, well, we survived another year at Mohonk, Dana. Let's not to target you. Dana made it. It's like Keith Richards or something. I've turned you into Keith Richards in my mind.
Yeah, my handlers rolled me out of bed and brought me in.
I don't know if I've ever said this into a microphone, but I honestly don't know whether I've ever seen you take a drink one time.
I just swilled down 3 glasses of wine last night.
Oh, wow. Okay, well. Now is the moment in our show where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Well, because we were just so withholding in that very sweet question about whether we ever withhold endorsements, I will make an intimate endorsement today. So I had various sort of, you know, mediocre cultural products I could have reported on. But honestly, even though this is sort of a callback to some earlier discussions, either in endorsements or in Audible that we've had on the GabFest, I feel the need to reveal to you all, Steve, you know this already, that last week in a plane somewhere over Utah, I finished Moby Dick.
Yeah.
Yay. So I feel like the listeners who know that I've been reading that book only on vacation for the last 5 years and sort of pleasurably slipping back down the mountain and climbing back up a little bit again and just finding my way through that huge digressive mountain of a book. It was so incredible to finish it in particular. Actually, I do have it within Moby Dick. I'm endorsing the last 3 chapters, which Steve and I just discussed yesterday at lunch, which are this incredible marvel of synthesis where this book that's the most digressive thing you've ever read that's been going on for 400 pages about blubber ambergris. Rendering and ambergris and the whiteness of the whale and just every single chapter goes off on some complete mental rabbit hole. But there are also all the while there are characters and themes being introduced, right, and kind of linguistic, you know, tropes being put into play and all of that stuff in the last 3 chapters, which comprise the 3 final days of hunting of the whale. I think they're called first day of the hunt, second day of the hunt, third day of the hunt, something like that. All of those intangible things coalesce into this incredible thriller. Yeah. And suddenly it becomes this very tense story of a whale hunt and a shipwreck. And all of those characters, the carpenter and Pip and all of these characters you've met along the way, you know, come to their fate. And it's just biblical in its glory.
You know, a couple things really quickly. It's amazing how few, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but how few literary figures really were rediscovered posthumously, because it's so fixed in our mind, the notion of the heroically starving artist. I mean, there's certainly many people who had some success and then fell into obscurity. However, Melville really is one. I mean, Melville had an early bestseller with Type E, his first book, because it was a true story of his experience being stranded in the South Seas among cannibals. It's an incredible book. It's a great book. But after that, he was really kind of a horrible nobody. A professor.
Well, it was Moby Dick that ruined him, right?
Yeah.
The problem was that he published this sort of unreadable, unconquerable book and then proceeded to lapse into obscurity.
Right, and followed it up with the less readable Pierre, right? I mean, but a professor of mine once said, and I want to throw this out to our audience because I'm curious whether it's true or whether I've kind of mangled it in my poor remembrance but he claimed that Melville was still sort of aspiring, as he started Moby Dick, was still aspiring to the success of Type E, but just in a more fictionalized form, and wanted to write a kind of 3 years before the mast, or whatever that book is called, adventure story. And midway through it, he met Hawthorne. And it was the fact of meeting Hawthorne and seeing in his actual person a writer of like the highest and most serious ambition that Moby Dick takes this turn and becomes, I mean, the total masterpiece of, you know, existential dread and weirdness that it is.
So it's dedicated to Hawthorne in a great
right?
dedication.
I'd forgotten that. So I'm really curious. I mean, it's just such a great book.
Oh, man. I got to reread that book, I think. Or maybe I'll just read the last 3 chapters. I read that when I was, like, so callow. I was, like, lifeguarding, and I was 17, and I was just such a snot. And
God, a lifeguard stand is such a good place to read Moby Dick, though.
Yeah, there were lots of white whales in front of me. And I just...
Oh my God, that is the single funniest thing said in 5 years on the GabFest. Oh my God.
I'm not sure I agree. Yeah, I don't know quite why that strikes Steve's fancy.
There were a bunch of like obese, poached skin beachgoers, right? You weren't talking metaphorically, were you?
Oh, there was one guy in particular
who was like an EMT, and he, so he should have known better. And his and he was like heart attack body, heart attack age, and he his preferred way of quote unquote swimming was just to like lie prone face down in the water and float there for like 40 to 70 seconds at a time, giving me a heart attack until he would just like reach up his head and go. And then like, go back into the water. So just one in particular. He should have fucking known better. He drove an ambulance. Anyway, I was just such a snot. I was like, oh, wow, this book really needed to get edited. Like my fledgling editor, Julia Turner, was just like, this is,
let's tighten this up a little.
All of these useless tangents. I think I need to read that now that I'm older and wiser.
Yes. Julia, what do you have?
My favorite thing about the Slate Retreat is dancing. It's like sad when all your friends get married, but before their kids start having bar mitzvahs, you don't get to like dance as much as you did in the like you, when you're in your 20s, you can go dancing. Then all your friends start getting married, you get to dance every few months at somebody's wedding. Then they all start getting divorced and everybody's kids are small and there's a dancing drought. But there's a great dance party tradition at the Slate Retreat. And I love the moment when a song comes on and you're trying to figure out if it is danceable and if it is danceable for you. Like you're trying to find your groove to a particular song. And as the night gets later and later, the songs get weirder and weirder because all the top cuts have been gone through. And there was a great moment late last night where the Beyoncé song EXO came on from her album from last fall, last December. And it's kind of slow and like anthemic and has a weird syncopation in it. And there was just a collective moment of everybody kind of pausing and figuring out like, is this danceable? And then it became like euphorically danceable. Mm. So the song is Beyonce's XO, and I guess dancing to it. You can do that by yourself in a room, and it will foster your inner life.
Oh, wow. That's
I didn't see you fantastic. On the dance floor last night, Steve. Do you dance?
Well, my favorite thing about the Slate Retreat is the my annual attempt not to play like a total ass clown during the soccer game that's at 4 o'clock after we break up from the conferences. And so I like busted. It was the one thing I can do out on the soccer field is just hustle and hustle and hustle. So I spend 2 hours. I mean, basically what I most wanted to do is make sure David Plotz's team lost. And so I was like a little terrier out there, like a terrier on cocaine, basically. And so I had nothing in the tank by the time the dance party started. I'm a white whale on a soccer pitch, just for the record.
But you're Ahab on the dance floor.
Exactly.
Some year we'll get you out there.
Yeah. So in celebration of our status as only a podcast now, I'm going to endorse 5 things. I'm going back to the old Metcalf, and y'all can go fuck y'all if you don't
Andy
like
Bowers
it.
Is going to harpoon you.
No, I'm not really, but I'm going to endorse a couple things. The first is I have to ask you, Dana. Okay, so there's one form of movie grade inflation, which is you're amongst the connoisseurs at a film festival and your connoisseur goggles make you think everything you see is a work of genius. The other one is you're on a 7-hour airplane flight and all the other members of your immediate family are asleep and you can't drift off and you watch the other woman and laugh hysterically through the entire thing. But I then watched another movie which I loved and I don't know what your opinion on it is and I'm not sure whether I love it or whether I grade inflated it. Dana Stevens, The Lunchbox. Go.
Oh, I haven't seen The Lunchbox. Oh! That's the Indian, the one with Irfan Khan
yes!
from this year.
I loved it.
I've heard really good things, and that's on my before the end of the year in case it's on the top 10 movie, but I did not see it and review it.
Okay,
what is it? I don't know it.
Okay, so it's very quickly. I don't actually know the name of the director and the writer, so I'm sorry about that, but because I thought I'd throw it to Dana and she would. But anyhow.
So much for expertise.
Famously overprepared. Stephen Mack. Anyway, it's an Indian movie, and the setup is basically, and this is true, like Harvard Business School went and studied how lunches go from the private kitchens where they're cooked by independent women.
This is in Mumbai, right?
Yeah. And then sent through the highly Byzantine articulated streets of the city out to the men who are working in the offices, like highly gendered division of labor, such as it is. But that's effectively how the office working men of Mumbai are fed. And it's such a precise system over so many millions of different lunches and men that someone wrote a kind of iconic Harvard Business Review article about how they do it, from which came this notion that this might be a basis of a really interesting story in which a frustrated widower office worker, I wouldn't say frustrated, lonely widower office worker, is being lunch serviced by a frustrated arranged marriage, you know, woman. And the two of them, because of some early snafu, begin exchanging notes. And it's to call it "You've Got Mail" is to say something so egregiously debasing to it that you want to cut your own head off immediately after saying it. So it's kind of like "You've Got Mail," except human and smart and beautiful and courageous in some ways. I really liked it. But I have no context other than, like, you know, I was in a plane over the North Atlantic and bored shitless and unable to sleep. So I don't really have five. I only have one.
Steve, such restraint.
I know, it's true. I'm corseted.
Mohonk.
Yes, exactly. Well, on that note, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
For dragging your sorry ass in this morning, hungover sorry ass in this morning. Julia, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
That was such a pleasure.
Steve, before you send us out with the credits, we got to let our Slate Plus listeners know. So first of all, they have their chance for early tickets to Boston. We're not actually doing a Slate Plus segment. We are doing a video interview, which will show our bedraggled and sorry asses in all too clean crow's feet and lack of eye cream use. Too much detail. So you can come to the Slate Plus site to see that if you want to hear us interviewed, interrogated.
Were we being filmed during the making of this episode?
You'll never know, Steve. I also want to say that Dana Stevens has drawn on her notepad as notes during the show, like a little inverse pyramid of hearts. I think she's drawn like 31 hearts on a notebook, and I'm going to take a picture of that and Instagram that. So that's also Slate Plus content.
It's not a sanatorium here.
All right.
All right. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Ann Hepperman. Our intern is Josephine Livingston. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. And our Twitter feed is Slate Cultfest. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?